The views and opinions expressed by guests on this show are those of our guests, not necessarily ours. We are interested in presenting different viewpoints and strive to be neutral parties. We leave it up to you to make your own judgments. Welcome to Vision Chat, a podcast about spiritual topics, with your hosts, Virginia and Stina.
Welcome back to Vision Chat. Virginia and I have the pleasure of interviewing Melissa Kim Corder. Melissa Kim Corder is a depth psychologist who studies darkness. Melissa speaks, writes, and teaches about narcissism and the shadow. She is highly empathetic and has been intuitive since she was a child. Melissa is also an international best-selling author and has written multiple books. We are very excited to have you on the podcast, Melissa. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be here with you both.
Yeah, it's so nice to have you on and to like explain, because I feel like there's a lot of misconception or maybe taboo around darkness. Would you like to start off talking a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thank you so much for the opportunity. And that's exactly part of why I do the work, is because there is so much misconception. There's a lot of fear and uncertainty. And I think that darkness is a natural part of life and our experiences, but we've filled in what darkness is. We've assigned our own meaning to it. And usually that comes from fear. So if we can reframe how we experience darkness and recognize that it's also stillness, it's also a place of deep connection. Darkness doesn't have to only be about the uncomfortable or malevolent parts of life or anything like that. It actually can be the place where we generate from. So if we think about creativity, if we think about even in nature, planting a seed into the soil and the earth, it's necessary. It's in darkness before it reaches the light, before it allows the sun in. So darkness is something that I see as a necessary part of who we are. And I like to reframe it for people to explain. It's easy to kind of move more toward, let's think of darkness as the hidden parts of us, the unknown parts of us, but that also can be filled with great potential instead of just fear, anxiety, or anticipation of uncomfortable things.
To add to that, I heard someone once explain it that not to fear the darkness, because if you think about it, the womb is dark. Yeah. And so when we're being, developed and we're about to be born into the world, we're in darkness. So the darkness also allows for us to be born and to develop.
Absolutely. That's actually a really great symbol that I work with a lot, is the womb itself as an incubative space, as a way of, for some of us, it's healing, right? Well, if we're moving through something, whether it's a physical illness or even a cold or a flu or something, we want to be cozy and warm. We want to be tucked in our beds. We want that nurturing essence or energy. And we often, when we're faced with something like that, we'll automatically want to retreat into those spaces. But we can also do that intentionally too, to imagine that what we're going through is its own sort of a womb. It's unknown. It's not maybe clear yet on where we're going or what we're doing in a particular circumstance. But if we trust the space of that womb in this symbolic way, everything will be provided. Everything will show up. We just have to learn how to be in that unknown. We also call it a liminal space. It's not where we came from. It's not where we're going. We don't yet know what's happening. But I love the womb as a symbol of helping us go through these times of even like reframing darkness to indecision, just uncertainty. it can also be exciting. It can be the anticipation of something new coming in that we've been waiting for. And still we're left in the space of not yet, we're not there. What else do we need to kind of nurture or be with in this time so that that newness can take root or take form?
So before we continue getting more into the darkness, because I'm loving this conversation, but one of the things that we like to ask all of our guests is just what label are you comfortable with, or how do you identify, or how do you explain who you are to people that are coming to see you?
Sure. So I'm a depth psychologist, and I often will just say, I don't consider myself a healer or anything like that, but more just a facilitator, a mentor facilitator, because I really believe that we all have everything we need within us, kind of like the womb again. And sometimes we just need someone to be with us, or a guide, or someone to facilitate process, or help remind us of our power when we're feeling disconnected or separate from. So often I try to be very casual with my clients and colleagues, and make it like we're sitting together in these spaces. Because sometimes when people say, like, even psychologists, there can be this natural, like, oh, you're on a pedestal and I'm over here. And I've never really operated well within those dynamics. I feel like we're all kind of sitting together. I imagine we're like sitting around this fire, you know, having a conversation and just being human and talking about the deepest parts of us. I come from a little bit more of like that type of perspective of like, we all have things we're moving through. I might have some tools that can help and support you along the way, but you also have wisdom, tools, things you've learned, and we can just discuss and share those and see what resonates, you know, and move through it together.
So how did you get like started with being curious about the darkness, or like where did this all started?
Yeah, such an interesting question. So I have a unique past. And essentially when I was a child, I used to play these games that were just very symbolic, like what we're talking about here. So one of the first things I found myself doing over and over again was, first of all, my home where I lived was on the end of this dirt road, and it was like 30 miles of dirt road. And then after my home, there was a normal suburban kind of neighborhood past that point, but there were all woods surrounding my house. And so one of the things I would do is gravitate toward the woods. I always felt like my home was outside in nature. And I would play this game where I would flip over stones. And I had this natural curiosity. I wanted to know what was under it. I didn't like if things were hidden or concealed. I was like all the time just uncovering things and looking for things, seeking. And that pattern just grew and it grew and it grew. And, you know, there's a shadow side to seeking and curiosity also. It can lead us into spaces and experiences that aren't always of our best interest. So anyhow, there was one particular time where my curiosity was growing, and I was also, I also had this other side of my life where I was very sensitive, very intuitive. I would see, sense, and feel things that other people didn't seem to understand or have the same response to. And there was also a lot of turmoil within the family. So there was a lot of mental illness, instability, a lot of difficulty when it came to like mental health and emotional health and things like that. And so I kind of was between these worlds of like being really empathic, feeling things deeply, and recognizing the imbalances of my family and what wasn't being said, what wasn't being dealt with. And I sort of just like a little sponge took it all on. And that I didn't understand what was happening. So that these feelings, I would feel people's emotions. I would actually process emotion for other people, not knowing I was doing any of this at the time. I just felt like I had this sadness and heaviness. And so I would go into the woods. And when I went into the woods, being around the trees and the stones and just playing these games and using my curiosity, I would decompress. So it's almost like nature just took it all over, took on all the heaviness, took on all the anxiety, all the unfelt feelings and the things that were just too big for me to understand at the time. The natural world seemed to somehow balance and compensate that. But anyhow, there was a pivotal moment in this process, this journey of being drawn into this work that happened. So that's kind of like the setting the tone for all of it. And then around 14, I'm not exactly sure of the exact age, but I think I was around 14 years old, 15 years old, when my mother sat me down and she's like, listen, we need to have a talk. I was starting to get involved with just a lot of unhealthy people and behaviors and substances and all of this stuff. And my mother was also very intuitive and she didn't see these things, but I think she sensed them in me and these changes in me. So she sat me down and she's like, listen, this world isn't as wonderful and amazing and loving as, you know, you wanted to believe. And you're sneaking out of the house and you're staying up at night and just going for walks like in the dark by yourself. So she was worried. She was really worried for me. And then she reveals to me that there was a known serial killer in the area and they had found bodies and stuff like near the home where I grew up. And so she's telling me this as if it's going to scare me or kind of like help rein me in a little bit to not be so wild and feral and, you know, but instead it made me more curious. Like, what do you mean? Why would that happen? Who is this person? I all of a sudden felt my curiosity amplify. And I just felt so compelled to want to understand the mind and the hidden part of us. I saw it through these more intense kind of dynamics and studying those types of individuals, disturbances, psychopathy and these different, and narcissism, the darker parts of many of us that we all have, but were sort of amplified in these certain, in these individuals that were just really unsettling to think about. But I was curious about that. And then the other side was also curious about the emotional patterns within my family, the different personality traits and characteristics. I didn't understand these things that I saw as something others weren't talking about. I started to recognize that people don't feel safe or comfortable discussing things that make them uncomfortable. And yet for some reason, my mind from a young age through this entire time just always wanted to go right into those topics. I wanted to talk about them. I wanted to reveal things. I wanted to understand. And so I really think that's where all of it began, was this curiosity that I recognized also had some parameters to it that could be potentially dangerous if we're not engaging intuition with curiosity. But that's a big part of where all of it began, was sort of trusting that feeling and following my creativity with my curiosity. And it led me to exploring all of these interesting things that I realized a lot of people wanted nothing to do with.
So your mom basically told you the story of a boogeyman to try to keep you safe.
Yeah.
And instead you were like, ooh, tell me more about this boogeyman. Why does he do what he does? Let me find out.
Exactly. And then I find out there's two boogeymen and they're in opposite parts of, like, it gets really intense and crazy. But the other thing around darkness, and I know that to work with darkness and shadow, we don't have to take that route. That's not going to be for everyone. You know, there. So for people that are curious around working with shadow and darkness, it doesn't mean that you have to go study these terrible people or things. There's just some people that will be inclined to do that, but there's many other ways to go about it. Yet it's really more the idea of how do we work with discomfort? How do we acknowledge the things within us and around us that we want to turn away from? And psychologically where stuff comes in is we have these different parts to our psyche. And if we realize what's happening in our moments of tension, and discomfort. We're actually growing an essentially fundamental part of the psyche, which is called the ego. And we're strengthening this part of us every time we do something challenging, every time we confront a fear, every time we overcome an obstacle. We're growing this part of us to become more and more stable. And that's the same part of us then that knows how to find safety. It resorts to coping mechanisms at first, which is that part of us that's like, this isn't safe, look away, this is evil because we don't like it or we can't understand it. That's very different than the deeper part of us that says, this isn't safe, maybe because there's something here that you're not meant to be a part of, or you know, you'll just be driving and all of a sudden it's like, turn right. You don't know why, but something's just telling you, right? So intuition, we can also misunderstand intuition for the mind wanting to protect us. And that's part of the work I also do, is helping people understand the benefits of shadow, that it isn't always just these negative things, even though those mysterious negative things, a lot of them happen to be my doorway into the work. For someone else, it might be wanting to actually embrace a quality, a skill, a gift, a talent, because within shadow is also parts of us we haven't met yet. So it isn't just like the repressed things we don't want to think about or that are, you know, too distasteful to think that we have these qualities. But it's also, you know, the part of us that maybe wants to become more confident, maybe has this dream that they want to follow or go after, maybe wants, you know, something else within their identity or persona that they want to draw out. That too comes from darkness. That too comes from shadow. It's, I often describe it as invisible light. You know, it's got its own consciousness, but our consciousness, this part of us, so the ego is a part of us that kind of lets us see things. It's the way I describe it to my clients is like a metaphor of having a flashlight. You know, it's got this spotlight that's pointed on something. And that's sort of whatever we're seeing through the light of that flashlight. That's kind of how the ego works. When we build the ego and our ability to be with tension or discomfort, or resistance, essentially, we're strengthening that ego. So it isn't so such like a blunt light, but more of a dimmer switch. And all of a sudden, more starts to come into our awareness. So spiritually, this would be where we start to recognize like, oh, I'm not my pattern. I have a pattern. Or I did this thing and I'm not bad, but there's something within me that it's time that I address or I look at. So we start to kind of see more of ourselves, but it also happens in the positive sense of, oh, isn't it interesting? I felt more confident in that moment just now. I want to nurture more of that. So I think that's helpful for people that are like darkness and shadow. And, you know, it can be mysterious. It can include topics of death and decay and all of these intense things, but it also can be the invisible light of who are we becoming? What qualities are we really ready to embody within ourselves, in our purpose or in our purposes of life, and how we show up and contribute to the world?
It's so interesting how you explain with the ego, because I've heard a lot of people or spiritual people also said, oh, you have to have an ego death, or you have to get your ego out of you to then wake up and be spiritual. So it's very beautiful, and it's so much knowledge that you just shared with us. So thank you. Wow.
Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity. And it's also something I also had a lot of misconception around. The same thing you're speaking to is the, you know, thinking like the ego needs to go away. It's harmful. It's causing all these problems. And it does affect us, you know, if we're, so basically when I teach about shadow work, or I explain to people what the shadow is, I kind of give them a little bit of a framework of the psyche so they understand the territory we're kind of working with. And basically what I'll say is, you know, the psyche, first of all, is the Greek word for soul. And that means many things to many people. So it isn't necessarily about believing one particular thing about what the soul is, but just knowing that there's these dynamics to it. It has all these working parts that are interconnected. And so within the psyche, we think of this as like a framework, again, that like interacts with the outer world and the inner world. And so on the outside of this, this framework, we have the layer of us that meets the world. And this is called the persona. This is also known as the personality, the mask that we wear to the world. And it's kind of like our skin in a way. It's protective. It's where we show who we are. It's how we speak. It's how we dress. It's the outer part of us that other people can see and engage with. And so that's kind of the outside of the psyche. But when you start to go deeper into the layers of the psyche, the next layer is the ego. And the ego is going to dictate what's happening with that persona. So for example, and there is an ego death, multiple ones, we call it ego side that we go through for sure. But it's usually a humbling process. It's usually one that's necessary. And so what happens is the first part of our lives, we're kind of, we would say our orientation, so our focus of that ego is on the outer world. How do we fit in? What are our roles in the world and society? What's acceptable of us to behave, how to show up, how to interact with people? So that's then what the persona will kind of demonstrate. You know, we'll smile at certain things, we'll try to fit in and belong. But the ego, once it realizes, once we start to have more consciousness, we recognize that it's playing it safe. It's operating out of coping mechanisms. And this is where I think things get misinterpreted when it comes to like spirituality or personal development, and where we start to hear things like, oh, we have to get rid of the ego. I've heard it so many times in different ways. And I do understand what they mean by that, but essentially we're not getting rid of it. We're actually building its strength, so that it can operate differently, can have perform different functions. One of those functions is shifting from the outer to the inner. This is where we start going deeper in the psyche. And so I won't go through all the layers because it's very complex and it's wonderful and I love describing it, but it would take a long time. So once we get past the ego, then we move into the deeper self. And then past in this framework of the psyche, we move through the deeper self, and then we get into this territory of the unconscious. Part of the self is in the unconscious and part of it's conscious. And then we get into the shadow, which is part of the unconscious. So all shadow means is we can't see it. We can't point at it and say it's located here. We can experience shadow, and we experience it through our reactions, our feelings, our sensations. So a shadow, just like darkness, is not bad. It's literally a field that contains complexes, a field that does contain all the things we push down. When we consciously push down, we are suppressing. When the psyche pushes things down on our behalf, or the ego because it's too much, or a traumatic situation or impactful moment, that would be repression. So that's like an automatic process. Suppression, we actually do consciously. And then oppression comes from the outside, where we feel oppressed by others or circumstance. But all of this is important because all that energy has to go somewhere. So the things we don't want to know about ourselves or can't see within us, we will project onto other people. And so projection is a huge part of ego development and working with shadow, because it gives us the opportunity to become conscious of our choices, of our actions. So if we see someone behaving in a certain way, it's not literally saying, I have that in me and it's showing up in this exact form, but it's something that gets our attention. And the way that we know there's shadow here, or something for us to work with, is because there will be an emotional charge. If there's no emotional charge, it can just be a neutral insight. I don't resonate with that person. We don't have much in common. Therefore, I don't have to spend time with them. But it's not this really difficult pushing away or cutting them out because of, you know, we're really just reacting and not recognizing it. So shadow will show up in all these different ways. But again, it isn't negative or positive, because the shadow will also work on our behalf. It'll be the moments where we slip and we say something that we didn't want to say, but needed to be said. So it might be a moment where you hear yourself saying something and you're just like, oh my gosh, where did that come from? But it actually works in your benefit. You know, it's not just like an embarrassment or a slip of the tongue that happens too, but it's almost like a fierceness that can come through, a boundary that we all of a sudden enforce. And we're kind of like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I wanted to do that. And that's great. But I can't believe I just did. Like, so the shadow is also something that will show us where we're not acting or taking action in ways that are really aligned for us. So we can use it as a tool, as a guide, by tracing and tracking these hidden parts of us to go, I wonder why that conversation left me feeling this way. I wonder why I get so charged over when that topic comes in or I'm around that person. You start to trace these elements and realize it isn't really about the circumstance, but it's about the energy and the emotion. And there's usually some other deeper core to the experience. And so shadow and darkness can help reveal these things, which is why I also call it invisible light.
Thank you so much for that explanation. There's a lot there. So if I can understand it correctly, like the way you're saying what shadow is, so if we were to explain what is shadow, can we say it's basically what we're not seeing, and it's also made up of the things that we don't want to see and that we suppress?
Yeah.
Okay. And so I hear this thrown around a lot in social media, like shadow work. So for people that don't know, including myself, because sometimes I get confused with that because I hear different things. If you're going to explain to someone the work that you do and you're explaining shadow work to someone, how would you explain just basically what it is? Or is it what we just talked about?
It's a combination of what we just talked about, but there's a lot of different ways I go about it. So I tend to use film, fairy tales, and forensics are the three main ways that I work with shadow. Because really, shadow, exactly what you just shared, it's we're making darkness conscious. We're bringing things to light. Where it gets a little tricky is when people aren't as well versed in shadow or understand what it necessarily means, which is fine. That's a lot of us. We're learning, we're experiencing these things. But the shadow itself isn't something we get rid of. Just like the ego isn't something we get rid of. It shifts though. So what we're doing is actually we're assimilating and breaking down the content that's unknown, that's within shadow. That's really what we're accessing, but also embodying and integrating these qualities that are meant to remain and become part of us in a bigger way, in a more solidified way. So that's kind of the short version of it. But the way that I operate within this territory is by paying attention to the metaphors, the myths, the symbols, the language of the soul. So if we remember also that the shadow is working on our behalf it's a part of a greater process. This bigger process that's underway is called individuation. And individuation basically means that the psyche that we have is self-regulating. And what that means is just like the nervous system is self-regulating, where it's trying to bring us back into balance over and over again. It's trying to bring us back into a state of balance. The psyche does the same thing, and the shadow plays a role in that. And so the idea of individuation is we're continuing throughout time, throughout our lifespan, to become more and more of who we're meant to be. We're uncovering things, maybe talents or gifts or even dreams that we had in childhood. Like we're kind of retrieving some of that childhood nostalgic enchantment in a sense. We're bringing that in as we're moving through life and learning to have more joy and connection and things of that nature. But we're also working with tension, which is that idea of being able to be with discomfort and things that are creating resistance. Resistance is a huge part of this process of individuation. doesn't always have to feel terrible or intense, but it's just that leaning into curiosity, leaning into things we don't understand and trying to learn more, to make meaning of things that were difficult too. So there's a lot of symbolism in that. But the reason that I choose film, forensics, and fairy tales to help make darkness conscious is because there's different figures where we can look at them as examples. We can learn from their patterns of behavior. So one of my favorite things, honestly, is psychological thrillers. And I have helped people process difficult emotions in their life or challenging things by looking at these films. And it's not always just the difficult things that come up in a really intense, good, like psychological thriller or a horror movie. Sometimes it's the redemptive quality we're looking for, which means what are we paying attention to in that storyline? How is that character in that film or in that story collecting themselves, healing their wounds, coming back to wholeness, even in these really intense states? So a psychological thriller, for example, I use the movie Silence of the Lambs quite often, and not to go into the whole movie, but the important piece of the movie is we have a very strong female character who we're seeing navigate through these different experiences with intense, horrific figures, and she's reclaiming her power every step of the way. So sometimes we're drawn to these things thinking like, oh my gosh, what's wrong with me that I like horror movies or psychological thrillers, only to take it a couple layers deeper and go, actually, there's something beautiful unfolding within us if we're drawn to those things in a healthy way. And it's part of that individuation process that we're just becoming more and more of our authentic selves. So that's one of the ways I use it. But then also in fairy tales, I have my clients research different fairy tales and the old school fairy tales, not the watered down versions that are fluffy and, you know, always positive. But the point is, a fairy tale can help us learn how to be with conflict and contrast. We can see parts of our own life experience as it unfolds. We start to acclimate to the psyche and go, oh, isn't it interesting in this story? They're always going deep into the forest, into the woods. It's the same journey as going deep into the unconscious. What are we going to encounter? What's going to show up on the path? How will we engage with it? And I've experienced women heal, and men too, but I just primarily work more with women, them heal from these really deep wounds, psychological, emotional. We call them we'll call it fragmentation or the splintering of the psyche. Sometimes it's referred to in shamanism as soul loss. And the idea is that there's parts of us that when that tension that we're trying to build and work through, when it's too discordant, it forces it to split in half. And it's not as scary as it sounds. It just means a part of us feels divided. A part of us feels separate from another. And the idea of individuation, that bigger theme, is we're bringing the parts back together. So we can do that through storytelling. We can observe this happening when we see something unfold in a fairy tale and realize that everything has symbolism. And then what happens is the clients often will have a certain a symbol, a pattern or theme that stands out to them. And it kind of becomes an anchor for them to work with as they're learning to retrain the mind, the ego, to navigate the challenge. And also the other hidden thing that happens within that is they learn how to be the one that rescues themselves. So like instead of in a certain story where we're waiting to be saved, we're waiting for someone to step in, it's very empowering to realize I'm on this journey. I can't control everything that's happened to me or that will happen in the future. But for right now, I'm going to trust that my instinct, my intuition is leading me. And how can I honor that for when I'm moving through something where I can't use my eyes or trust my eyes on what I see? So that's a favorite part of the work too, is a byproduct of shadow work is you really build this incredible connection to your intuition. You sort of reclaim your instinctual nature that's been chipped away or broken down over time. You know, and it's not to put everything back on our parents or anything like that. It's more to say there's patterns, though, that have emerged through childhood and as we grow up. And if we can understand those patterns, those cycles, we're also empowered to break them. I call it breaking the trances, you know, and coming out of these states of slumber. I use a lot of language around fairy tales and stuff because it helps us give words to experiences that are meaningful, but again, from a place of empowerment too.
That is so interesting. I was thinking about, I don't know if this is a little off the subject, but I feel when it comes to like scary movies and stuff like that, it is a kind of a split. Some people can handle it and others cannot really watch anything because they get too paranoid and too invested, I guess. What do you think about that?
That's such a good awareness. And I think this is where it's also about knowing and trusting ourselves. I think that if we're like, I'm a very deeply sensitive person, but it's kind of funny because I'm also, I love all that stuff. So like as sensitive and as intuitive as I am, I don't feel the impact of it while I'm observing, but there's something happening where I'm aware that I'm an observer. Even if I get lost in the experience of it, there's still something there within me that recognizes the deeply symbolic nature of it. So I'm always kind of looking for the patterns, the associations, the connections. And it's not for everyone, for certain. Like it isn't for everyone to use those things as a tool. But if someone's curious about that, they could and start kind of asking themselves questions of like, okay, what is it about this that scares me? And I think it's healthy to say, like, we don't need to have necessarily an intense amount of goriness or things like that. Like, I actually don't even care for that, too. I like more of the creative aspect of, like, if it's really intense, does it have my attention? Am I lost in the storyline? I think it does something to those of us that have that curiosity where we like not being able to know. We like being surprised, but in this way that feels safe and at a distance. So it can help people with things like that too. But for those that are noticing like, you know, it's just too much, what I would say is, one, does that feel okay? Does it feel okay that you just don't have a preference for those things? And if so, that's fine. They certainly don't have to be. But what I would ask is there an emotional charge to it? Is it an avoidance? Because maybe there's something really there that you're not acknowledging within yourself, or you're not able to confront within yourself. So you don't even have to go watch the movie to kind of do that type of shadow work, but you can just sit with like a journal and notebook and just ask yourself, like, what is it that repels me from those kind of things? What is it that, do I feel something in my body? Is there a somatic reaction that I don't like? And sometimes what we do is if you do that kind of a journaling process where you're really just engaging with these parts of you, you might get to the end of it and say, you know what? I really don't have an emotional charge around this. I don't enjoy those movies. They don't activate me in a healthy way. And therefore, I don't need to watch them, and that's okay. But if there is an emotional charge, then you might all of a sudden become curious and say, I wonder if there's something I could watch that's maybe not so intense and triggering, because we want to be mindful of that too, but maybe something that can teach me something new about myself. And maybe it's an opportunity where I can practice engaging that symbolic part of me that can see the patterns and the details and all the things without making it about the literalization of the action that's actually unfolding in the film itself.
Okay, so I'm going to throw a little bit of a curveball at you. You don't have to answer this if you don't want to.
I love curveballs. I actually get excited.
Okay, all right, good. So I don't want you to be like, oh my God, what is this woman asking me? So I'll use myself as an example. Stina and I have had these conversations before about, you know, like scary movies and things that are like scary. So if I watch The Exorcist and I'm scared and it stays in my head, you know, and then I can't sleep at night and then I need a light to stay on to sleep because I'm afraid of the darkness, what does that say about me?
Right.
What do I look at?
I love this. So a lot of things. I would say, first of all, The Exorcist is a really great example because not every film is so gripping. That's another thing. There's different levels of intensity with that specific movie. In fact, I'm reading a book about it right now on how many subliminal things were embedded in that film, how they purposely played on this dynamic of the audience, their senses, subliminal messages. There was so much energy and so much fear created around that. I also think that sometimes, and this may or may not resonate, but sometimes when we engage with those things, we're also kind of experiencing that what we would call like this archetypal energy that's kind of been created around this experience. And so sometimes I think we're tapping into that and feeling that. I don't think there's anything wrong with those feelings. What that tells me is actually you're probably deeply connected to the body and emotions. And that what I would do instead is I would write about, I wonder how I feel about the existence of those types of dynamics. Because sometimes it's also that if we take away all the goriness of the movie, we just look at sort of the, lack of a better way of saying it, the bones, like the bones of the film, we'd be able to kind of see like, okay, young innocent girl being taken over by this malevolent force, breaking that down, removing the literal, just getting to like a psychological. I wonder what it would be like to play around with the dynamic between an innocent individual and things out of her control. Or, and again, this can be physical, mental, emotional, spiritual. I would take these themes one at a time, because quite a few of them can emerge. Like even in that little snippet you shared, there's a bunch of different things where I would look at it and say, even the dark, even, you know, having to have the light on, what does the light do? What does it make go away? Is there something I want to go away here? It takes a willingness to explore and use the imagination with this work. But then the other thing too is like, I might even play with what darkness am I susceptible to? And that might be an idea, a thought, a pattern. I once had a client I was working with, we were using the fairy tale of Snow White. And what she was able to realize was poison. There's poison in the story in a few different ways where Snow White, the stepmother, tries to poison her on three different occasions. And my client, by doing a lot of this type of work, realized that her poison as a child was the terrible things that people used to say, and she would believe them. She would take them in. And so that's not the literal poison we're used to hearing in a story, like somebody actually sitting down and drinking a substance that it then impacts them. But energetically, emotionally, there's an infection there, or there's a toxin there, or there's something there that's affecting the psyche of system of that person. So in what you just described, I would say it doesn't have to be a poison, but maybe a threat or a vulnerability there of what is it that gets into the mind? What is the idea? Because even when we watch these movies, there's usually something. There's some type of central image. Sometimes it's the physical appearance of the character, especially in that type of film, where it's one of the first times we saw a child with like this terrible overlay, right, of these horrible things. For most of us, it's like, I don't want to think of something like that. I don't want to think of this monstrous force being able to, you know, prey on the vulnerability of a child. That in itself could really stir up a lot of themes, especially for people that have been through abusive dynamics of different type. I always like to use the term impact. I say this quite often, but a lot of us don't understand trauma or what trauma is or how it works, or we've heard the term, or maybe we are a little more well-versed in it. But what I like to say is I will use the word impactful moment, just because it takes away some of the curiosity around, or the misunderstanding around trauma. So what I might say is like, oh, is it possible that I have some type of impactful moment in my history and my life that is activated when I see these certain themes in films? And sometimes that can be helpful because it helps us start to address what I call the unfinished business within the nervous system. But other times it might be the source of more obsessive thoughts or rumination. If we don't know how to channel that emotion, that creativity, it can be a little chaotic. We can become a little obsessive or hold on to these ideas or let them linger. This is why journaling is such a powerful tool, because it kind of moves it out of the head and puts it on the page. So that's something I recommend too. If we're not sure, if it's very hazy or unclear, or we haven't yet connected the pattern, we can always go to a journal or notebook and kind of write things out. Even if they're not making sense, it will start to organize itself later. Just like this idea that we have this self-regulating part of the psyche, these parts want to bring us back into balance. So writing is a way where we can kind of like create the space for some of that disorganization to have a place to land, that helps that part of us start to find its footing. So these movies can really be very activating on a lot of levels.
Wow, it's so deep as well. It's incredible.
Yeah.
I was wondering, have you ever come across where you have felt like surprised of yourself or what this journey has been or the tools that you have, and surprise somebody else as well?
Yeah, all the time. Really, all the time. It's very surprising. And there's a lot of different ways. It can be surprising in a good sense. You know, it can be surprising in like a little bit of a nerve-wracking sense too. I think what that's about for me though, just examples, like even the, here's another example of the surprise in a good way. Because sometimes you just don't know. And even as I facilitate this work, I'm always very honest and transparent and will tell my client, I don't know what this is. Let's see what happens, and trust your body, trust your instinct. Trust, you know, if you don't feel safe or if you're feeling some other type of emotion or mood or tone, and we need to address that. Let's look at that. But the surprising thing, I work a lot with nightmares now. It's like, it's just a byproduct of working with darkness and shadow, but nightmares. And one of the most surprising things came about from making the connection for myself and the client, making the connection between being chased in a nightmare and, for her, this one particular situation, she had this as a repetitive nightmare. So it wouldn't go away. It kept coming back over the course of a few months or whatever it was. And being chased, at first, we literally looked at that like, okay, it doesn't feel good. Maybe it's something from the past that's coming back up for you to deal with. We kind of stayed on the surface a little bit and did like some of the typical, like if you're being chased, what would that mean? But the dream persisted, and it was so interesting because I had this intuitive hit and I was really nervous about sharing it, but that's how I work. I often will feel things and sense things while I'm working with a client. And so I've learned if you don't say it, you're actually doing them a disservice because usually there's something there. And so I heard my intuition, and it was like, tell her to stop running. And so I said to her, I'm like, I feel really nervous saying this to you, but what if you just stopped running from the shadowy figure that's like chasing you in your dream? And she attempted to, but it's not all of us are really good at like lucid dreaming, which is where you're like remembering your dreaming and you're consciously making a decision or a choice while the dream is happening. So what we can do instead is recreate the dream in the mind while we're sitting up and conscious and imagine engaging with the figure that way. So it's actually a process called active imagination where you engage and dialogue. And so she was doing both. She was trying to have, when the dream would come up, she was trying to become conscious in the dream and lucid dream and turn around and face the shadow, but it wasn't really working at first. But then she was also engaging with the dream on paper and doing that same thing. One day she has the dream and she's finally able to stop running. She stops running. She turns around. She faces the shadowy creature that's been chasing her. And all of a sudden it's like almost turns into a pile of like scarves or like, I forget how she described it, like silkiness. It was like a smoke or a haze. It got less dense, less physical, and became more like thinner and lighter. And then what happened is it's swirling about and it kind of like falls to the ground by her feet. And she looks down in the dream at her feet, and this weird shadowy thing turned into a fox. and it was curled up at the bottom of her feet. And when I work with animals and totems and things, I really try to refrain from Googling and researching that way. I tell the client, what does this represent? Like, let's see what your psyche, this part of you that knows everything, has all the answers to why it's presenting this image in the first place. Let's go to the source of that. So we did, and it took a couple of months because it's not a fast thing. It's really paying attention, deeply listening, noticing synchronicities in your life and things that are helping you to kind of discover more of this. And eventually she realized that fox was her intuition, her instinct. She had been running from it. So it was chasing her in her dream state. It was chasing her at night because during the day she wasn't listening to it. So the dream was the only way that this instinct could get her attention. The crazy thing about this is once she realized that, she connected it to this business situation that happened where when the dream had first started, she was presented with some type of business opportunity. And she knew that some of the people involved in that business opportunity. And so she was leaning towards saying yes and actually doing this. And yet she had these small red flags, these different things that were like, this might not be the best decision for you. But she kept squashing them and ignoring them and not really giving them much attention. So this dream is saying, hey, it's like chasing her, literally saying, pay attention here. And so ultimately, after she kind of processed the dream and made these connections, the dream stopped. She said no to the business deal. And within a short amount of time after that, she learned that that entire business deal imploded. And had she said yes to it, she likely would have had a lot of issues, financial ruin, things that really could have destroyed her career and her life and made it really challenging for her. So I thought, isn't that amazing how this dream started as a nightmare, this scary thing that she wants to run from, and it just happens to be the same thing that she needed to stop and face and listen to. And then it had the answer she actually wanted that was working on her behalf. That was surprising to me, that these intense images once again in the dream state could be a form of guidance like that. And I knew this logically, but watching it unfold in someone without them knowing logically and seeing the evidence of that, that to me was so surprising. And now I've retold this story so many times, it helps other people. Like her initial running from her shadow and confronting it is now helping all these people that hear the story, just because she had the courage to say, let's see what this is about. So yeah, that was probably one of the most surprising responses that I had observed.
And not to mention your courage for telling her what your intuition was telling you.
That's true. Yeah. You
modeled it for her and then she was able to run with it.
Yeah. Oh, that's so good. See, that's it. That's the work. I love it. So good.
I'm still kind of like really blown away by your explanation about how you're using film and fairy tales. I think that's such a creative approach. Do you feel like, this is kind of a big question too, so I'm sorry. So bear with me. Do you feel like as a society, are we moving more in the direction of we like the darkness and we like the scary stuff and we like, or are we moving in the opposite direction of like, no, like, you know, and the best way I can explain it is I was talking to someone who doesn't like surprises, gets triggered very easily. And she's like, oh, well, there's this website where you can go. You put the title of the movie you want to go see, and it'll tell you all these different like trigger warnings. And so that way, you know, and it'll tell you exactly where in the movie. So like, you can still go see it, but you won't be surprised by that element. And that way you won't get triggered. You know, like, are we in the Disney movies or like fairy tales, right? So I'm thinking Disney movies. So I have a daughter, and we used to sit and watch like all these Disney films. And the older ones, the classics, are very how do I want to say this? Like, there's some that are like kind of like darker. They have darker elements in them. And then you see the progression of like the newer films, and they're very light.
Yeah.
And they're very positive. Rarely ever any kind of death or like any kind of like real serious things going on. And I'm just, I don't know. Like, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this. Just like, are we as a society kind of moving more into like, let's stay light and positive and let's ignore the dark, or let's stay away from the dark, versus like maybe times before where maybe people were more open to that or weren't so afraid of it?
Yeah. Such a good question. I actually love this, because it's a huge, what you just asked is a huge driving force behind a project I'm working on right now. It's actually a dissertation, which is all about our darkness and holding it and being able to be with it, and the different figures that are sort of the scapegoats, because I don't think that we're really embracing our darkness. I think that we're currently, I do think there are people that are doing that kind of work, but I think there's a lot more of society that's being conditioned to be sensitive in the wrong ways. And I think mixed in there, there's some good intentions too. So it's difficult to kind of separate it all. But an example, just based on what you said, it's so interesting. You can type in the movie and see those things. And I could see the benefit of that. I could see the value of knowing. But I think, and this is where my opinion might sort of like really differentiate from a lot of people, and that's okay. I don't like trigger warnings. In fact, I just started a podcast and a new blog. And when I go on there, my very first episode I describe, I'm like, I don't believe in trigger warnings, and here's why. And I kind of talk about how it's shielding us, but not in ways I think it was intended to. I do think that there's a fine line for being very supportive, healing, nurturing, and safe for people to create experiences of safety, to retrain the nervous system, to heal from trauma, to build the ego. But I also think it's being misused. I think it's an opportunity to warn ourselves about something uncomfortable, instead of sometimes just being like hurled into it, is where you actually find your resiliency, not necessarily being warned of it. I think being warned of certain things actually gives the body a little bit more time to create more anxiety and a different story in mind. It starts some of those other processes sooner than they need to be. But anyhow, the reason I brought that up is because I did something called a darkness meter. And so basically I'll say, okay, this article is 1 skull out of 5. So if you're, you know, someone that's sensitive, like, you know, and you're uncomfortable talking about death, murder, decay, which comes up quite a bit in a lot of the work I do, because they show the natural processes of life and psychological, and I see these things as psychological movements to show us, like, even the idea of decay can sound so gross, but if we realize it's like a necessary process of helping to break things down, to assimilate things, to make things so that we can integrate them. When we start to look at the words, the images, the things that make us uncomfortable and question it, I think there's so much value there. But I think if we're warned of those things, we're not really giving ourselves the opportunity to expand in a way that I think we could be. Because here's the thing in life, if you get in your car and you decide to just go for a ride, you're not going to get a trigger warning that says, you know, if you go down this road today, you might witness a car accident. But, and that's the thing I think we're trying to protect ourselves on. But when you're trying to shield yourself, protect yourself in that way, what you're also doing is saying like, but also if I'm not going to be protected from getting in my car, driving down the road and having the most amazing encounter with a total stranger that could change the trajectory of my life, where maybe they have some piece of wisdom or insight for me that could just open my mind and set me on a different path. So the things we're, I feel, trying to shield ourselves from will also water down the numinous, magnetic, enchanted other qualities too that we're trying to kind of mitigate. So I feel like it's almost like saying, by avoiding darkness, we are also watering down the light. We are also dampening the beauty, the grace, the beautiful things, because we can't have one without the other. So what I feel like would be so helpful is if we embrace both. And we have so much of a connection to the light already, and we're misperceiving that, and we're projecting onto the light too. It's the same reason we will be drawn to certain figures in society, gurus, or these different leaders in government or religious, whatever, it doesn't even matter. But if we look at these different figures, we're projecting onto them these qualities, these unmet qualities within us, expecting the figure to hold it for us. And the danger in that is when we do that in the name of religion or spirituality or personal development, doesn't even matter, we're taking our power and putting it outside of us. So I definitely get a little wound up over this subject because it's important. And I think that we do have an unhealthy, one-sided appeal, draw, whatever, to positive things only. And I think that stories, our fairy tales, our movies are trying to show us that. And then the ones that aren't like that are written off as demonic and what have you. And it's interesting because what we don't understand, we often will project onto. So another example of this is one of the reasons I use forensics as a part of the work I do is because, and I won't get graphic or I promise not to go into detail around this, but some of the individuals that I study have done terrible things, unfathomable things. And so on the surface, if we just look at that, there's going to be many of us that are like, oh, that's just, that person's evil. They're a monster. But then there's other people that are like, well, wait a minute. If we just take away the emotion and we look at the patterns at play here, what contributes to this? And then all of a sudden, connections can be made. Insight can come together. We can realize, oh, this might be a manifestation of trauma also. This might be a manifestation of this over here. And we start to realize there's things always hidden beneath the surface. But our tendency to take something uncomfortable that we don't like and label it is more dangerous because it keeps us from looking any further. And we do this with things by saying, that's evil, that person's wrong, instead of maybe they are absolutely deeply disturbed. And maybe also they should be in a facility to keep other people from being harmed or what have you. But if we don't look, if some of us at least, if we don't look, I think we're denying that these things exist. And then I think it paints this picture for a case for saying it's evil when actually it's unknown. Is it possible that I just don't know what this is? And I don't like that I don't know because that makes me really uncomfortable and my brain wants certainty. What am I doing then in that moment? So that's another essence to shadow work is saying, I don't have to agree with this. I don't have to like it. And I certainly can steer clear of all of this, you know, as far as I don't have to study it or, you know, immerse myself in case files and studies and things that are intense and graphic. But it's not going to serve me to also think that everything is perfect, that there aren't harmful people in the world that see everything through the lens of rose-colored glasses, because then what happens is we dampen our instinct. So if we can live with duality, of darkness and light, and darkness as a form of invisible light. So we also don't put darkness in the side of only bad or wrong or evil. Also, there's something really magical that can happen. Like for example, studying all these things, there's a time when the personal development and spiritual communities would have been like, oh my gosh, be careful, because what you focus on, you're going to attract and it's going to expand. And honestly, what I can say is focusing on all of that stuff has given me such an appreciation for depth and intuition and instinct. I've learned from the sensitivity of other people. I've studied victims who have been on the receiving end of some of these things. And what I learned from studying some of them is some of them, not all of them, some of them were known to be deeply sensitive, empathic and caring, and people pleasers, or maybe didn't have the best boundaries, and that isn't a bad thing, but what we need to be reminded of is there's circumstances in this world, there's situations and people that look for that, to take advantage of that and exploit it. And it isn't for us to live in fear at all. That's not the direction I want to go in. But it is to say, if I'm deeply connected to my instinct and the contrast, the opposition of dark and light and all these things, then I might listen to my intuition when it says, yeah, you don't, maybe you don't want to trust that person. Or, you know, their face is telling me that they're kind and they're charming and they're wonderful and they're very disarming. But something in me is just saying, I don't know, something's not right. And what I've learned is that the more we can feel connected to our intuition, the more we have that type of dialogue with people, circumstances, decisions, whatever it might be. And actually, it creates a sense of safety because we're trusting ourselves so innately and not relying on what we see outside of us to tell us how to act. So it's all different forms of shadow work. And certainly, again, I know it doesn't align for everyone. And I'm not saying the answer is to go watch psychological thrillers or study serial killers. Those just happen to be the areas I study and look at because I found a way to create balance and healing and understanding for people in creative ways outside of this really intense stuff that a lot of people would rather not think exists. But that doesn't serve any of us to avoid darkness or difficulty, because I just said this to my husband the other day. I'm like, then why a firefighter wouldn't run into a building to put out a fire and save a family? They would have to go with their instinct, which says that's dangerous, that's going to kill you. The nervous system, which is saying run in the opposite way, away from the fire. But instead, they're having to go against their programming for a mission, for the job. Law enforcement, same thing. There's a lot of different roles we can see this in. And another weird example of this is I just had this kind of pop into my mind the other day. I was thinking about how, a grieving family, when they're going through the process of loss and death and with a loved one, and how the role of some individuals within, let's say the funeral home, would actually is doing this beautiful, amazing thing that helps that family to grieve by working with the body, by helping to keep dignity and the essence of this person intact in a way so that the family can go through their time of grieving. So there's these roles in the world that are considered like dark or gross, but it's sacred work. It's sacred work saying you're suffering. You just lost this person. I'm going to take care of this person and I'm going to work with them in a way that makes them look as the best they can. It's presentable so that your time can be spent on mourning instead of having to deal with these extra things. And I know this sounds really kind of weird, but if you think about it, it's just an example of a hidden role in the world that many people do in silence, in a way of being of service so that we don't have to think about those things. It allows the family or the loved one to have the experience of closure. But if we look beneath the layers of that closure, of that grieving process, there's other people that had to come in and deal with really difficult parts of that scenario that we don't want to acknowledge or look at. And I'm not saying we have to always uncover those things, but I think we can have appreciation for the difficult things that people do face on our behalf. And I think we can find our own way of doing that same thing and paying it forward within our life experience, within our creative means. And that to me is a big undercurrent to the work I do, is we don't grow without tension or resistance. And if we're only going toward the light, if we're only doing things that feel easy or comfortable, growth isn't necessarily happening there. Neither is healing, and likely we're perpetuating something, and we might even be creating a bigger divide or gap within ourselves.
There is a book called The Boy That Was Raised Like a Wolf or a Dog or something. And in that book, it's a psychiatrist that works with children with a lot of trauma. And he kind of gives up knowledge of his work that people that grow up as psychopaths or killers and stuff like that are usually the children that has experienced from birth a lot of distance from like caretakers and a lot of that. And I feel it's so easy to maybe blame or, well, of course, sometimes it's not, it's a very like a complex area, I think. But I think there's so much underneath that people just don't want to open up or like realize, okay, this can be something that is an effect of something that happened before again.
Yeah.
And just kind of throws it away instead of looking at it and see how that might be, can be worked on so it doesn't happen later on for other people, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely. And I love that. I'm going to actually have to check out that book. I agree. I think that, you know, again, it's, and I respect what you're saying too, because it is delicate, right? It's a, like a paradox a little bit there, where we want to be delicate to the nature of suffering, the suffering that has occurred at the hands of these individuals on one hand. So we don't want to like glorify them, which I think the media has done. And I think that's part of the issue with the true crime region, like, you know, topic of things or genre, which I fall very much into. I am like, I love reading about all this stuff. I don't love what's happened to people. I don't align with that part. It's more the curiosity around why people go off the rails, why these things happen to us. And it is interesting, right? It's so difficult for us to think of someone we've labeled as a monster as a traumatized child who never grew up or never had the opportunity to or whatever. Again, not always putting it on parents, because sometimes the environment is a big part of it. That's the whole nature versus nurture conversation. And sometimes it's both, but sometimes it's a brain development and intrapsychic sort of thing. Some of these individuals have a very fragile ego. They don't have a healthy sense of who they are. They don't always have the ability to deal with that resistance, the pressure, the oppositional energy within. And what has happened is some of them then the unconscious elements, those deeper impulses and things that are rising up to meet the ego, one of the ways they deal with that is through the behavior. They literalize the behavior. So they take an action that is literal that causes damage or harm. So the fantasy, they make it literal, whatever that might look like in those ways. For someone else that's built up that ego, they might have a compulsion. They might also have it flash through their mind of causing harm or doing something to someone, but they may not take action on it. And I think that's the difficult thing is we'll look at somebody and be like, well, not all of us are running around and doing this to people. Sure, but some of us are in our heads. And some of us have just different defenses that are unique to our circumstances. And it's really difficult for us to understand intrapsychically what happens in infancy all the way to like the age of 12. We have ideas. There's lots of concepts and ideas about what happens in the mind and consciousness and how we grow and develop and what we're taking in our environments and all of that kind of stuff. But these psychic splits, these really deep divides within us that are created, I think are part of that process. Similar to dissociative identity disorder, DID, it used to be called multiple personality disorder. There are parts within that same individual that are acting autonomously. And they will have different eye color. They will have different breathing patterns. They'll have different blood work. Sugar levels. It's amazing. These different parts within the same person can be tested and manifest differently within one individual. And I've seen this. I've observed it with my own eyes working with someone that had dissociative identity disorder. And yet, even though there's a lot of fear around that and we don't logically understand a lot of it, we turn it into movies or shows or things that sort of like exaggerate some of that. We do the same thing with psychopathy and serial killers and murder and things like that. The wrong things are often glorified instead of the, you know, trying to understand these deeper things. I actually work a lot with this. You'd be surprised how much it comes up with my clients where we will talk through things. And it's amazing because I find that women primarily, again, I'm not saying this to exclude men or others. I just notice the pattern more so with the women that I work with, or those that identify, you know, as female. They will have this sense of responsibility. They'll be very deeply feeling individuals that have this burden of responsibility, and they'll be the ones that are the people pleasers, or they feel like they've got to do the right thing. In their dreams, you'll have a murderer appear. And so talking through that, like at first they're like, what is wrong with me that this figure is showing up in my dream? But when we break it down, it's like, wasn't it interesting? It's just, there's a hidden part of you that's trying to kill off another part of you. So how can we look at that symbolically within the mind? How can we start to trace and track that energy? And it's amazing. So again, if we think of the psyche as self-regulating, coming back to the state of wholeness, sometimes wholeness is with the idea of ego side and the ego dying and being reborn over and over again. Different parts of us will go through that process as well. So in our dreams, we might see these really intense, ugly things. But if we remove the literal and we just go for the symbolic, the metaphorical, the what could this maybe be teaching me, we'll start to realize there's an integration process. I had a client once working with the theme of dismemberment. I won't go into that because, you know, it's pretty straightforward what it sounds like. But in her dream, this image would appear and it was really upsetting to her. We started working metaphorically with where are you compartmentalized in your life? Where are there parts of you that are doing things that you don't want those parts to do? Where are parts of you that feel cut off from yourself? So we symbolically work through that. And it was incredible how she actually discovered deeper dreams and desires that were kind of hidden, because sometimes these parts of us can be really dominant in our expression and suppress the others. And so the dream state can show us what's going on there. And so these themes that initially were like, oh my gosh, I would never talk about that, or I would never look at that. Again, it can be the exact medicine or the exact thing that opens a door and liberates whatever was going on in the psyche. So whether it's stuck energy or emotion or something that's just been an open feedback loop that's just not closing, all of a sudden it can be used in a different creative way. I've actually been known to give my clients homework on serial killers or things, just to like, not to go deeply into it, but just to be like, what is the pattern? What are the themes? What is it that your psyche maybe is trying to express if it's never had the opportunity to? I've also observed clients be able to finally tap into deep-seated anger and rage if they weren't allowed to express as a child. So sometimes that's the draw. We might be drawn to an intense movie where there's a lot of violence, and it doesn't mean we're a violent person. It might mean that the psyche is saying, hey, look at this way that this has shown up over here. You can learn from this. You can learn how to channel this for yourself. So it doesn't, you don't have to have it be so unconscious that you're sabotaging yourself in your life, or you're having some catastrophic event that has to show up, because these forces are unconscious because you refuse to deal with your anger or your rage. So it's really using these intense forms is one creative way to help people gain a sense of trust in themselves and their instincts, their intuition. But again, it's not glorifying the behavior, and it's certainly not giving permission to violence either. It's sort of like we tap into rage, but give it healthy containment so it's not wild and unruly and harmful to others.
You are such a creative being, and I'm so appreciative for your time and these explanations. It's been really fascinating. We'd love to do a part two with you sometime if you're up for it. But absolutely. In the meantime, where can people find you? Like, what kind of services do you offer? And yeah, give us all your contact info.
Sure. Thank you so much, first of all. The easiest thing is to go to my website. It's melissacorder.com. And on there, there's quite a bit of information. I have new blogs and writings and all different things that are launching. But there's quite a bit of info on there. So, you know, I work with nightmares and dreams. I definitely work with the darker side of the personality. I have a program called Radiant Darkness, where I teach some of these fundamental things and some pre-recorded lessons. But then we have phone calls together to kind of discuss or go deeper. I have mentoring groups that I run where we work with fairy tales and the shadow side of the personality. So there's always something cooking, always something going on. So the best thing to do is probably go to the website, and from there you can find all the different things that I offer.
You also have a podcast that you said you just launched.
I just launched it. Yeah, literally one episode. But it's called A Dose of Depth with Melissa Kim Corder. And the idea is that we'll talk about all this kind of stuff, film, fairy tales, forensics, and I'll have that little darkness meter before every episode so that people will know, like, this episode may or may not contain some of these things. But I feel really blessed to be able to do this work, and at the same time to help people feel safe in territory and topics and things that we're kind of taught to avoid or ignore. And my curiosity from a young age has always been like, oh yeah, you're going to tell me I can't go in that door? Well, guess where I'm going. So now I kind of feel like I attract or sort of like support a lot of what I would call like the mystical misfits of the world, because a lot of us have that shared kind of experience. So it's just such a joy and honor to work with people and to help them see these patterns, you know, these different patterns within and how they can work with them. A lot of people identify with like the invisible, we call it the glass child, or the black sheep, you know, they're different forms of being a scapegoat, that these different unconscious burdens that have been sort of placed on us. And it's because we're empowered to shift them. So I tend to really speak to those different personalities quite a bit, because I am one of those as well, right? And so it's beautiful to be able to do this work and watch the transformation that occurs within people. And I feel so blessed that I found this path, or this path chose me. And it's just great to be able to share about it. So thank you.
That's amazing. If there is a book people should start out with, of one of your books, which do you recommend?
Oh, I would say, you know, the Wild Woman series is really good. So we have, our third one is about to come out. So this is a collaborative project I actually run through my business, where I have all these other authors join me. But the Wild Woman series, we're on book number 3, which will be out next month. Well, I should say in October, it'll be out. But the other two books of that series are out. They're on Amazon. And so the first one is called The Wild Woman's Book of Shadows. The second one is Wild Woman's Book of Prosperity. And the new one that's about to come out is called The Wild Woman's Book of Alchemy. And it's all women that have come together to share these different types of stories and experiences, how they're healing, how they're working with spiritual principles and things and personal development. I would say those are probably the top three. And then I am really happy to announce my book, my next book will be out in the fall of 2025. And this is all about shadow work and the use of fairy tales and different things like that. So some of the stuff we talked about here today is going to be in that book. But that will be out in, like I said, fall 2025.
I can't wait. And I cannot wait to read the other books as well. Thank you so much for your time and every knowledge, every wisdom that you have had and shared here. It's going to make a difference for sure. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Vision Chat. You can find more about us at visionofprofoundhealing.com, where we offer readings, courses, and classes.